setback after setback, the need to play remains. That's Motion City Soundtrack. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays won yesterday, 10-6, but the day was marked by a number of setbacks throughout the organization. Ricky Tiedemann leaves his first start back at AAA with left forearm tightness. Adam Macko hits the IL at AA with left forearm tightness. Eric Swanson had left the game Tuesday ill. Jimmy Garcia had a rehab assignment at AAA Buffalo, pushed back for a second time due to neck stiffness. And then at the major league level, Dalton Varsho comes out of a game after an awkward play at first base with a knee contusion. Bo Bichette comes out of the game after dealing with calf soreness in the same calf that sent him to the IL earlier. Even the third base coach left the game hurt. So yes, Jays won 10-6, but man, bad news all around for a Blue Jays organization that has had a lot of it this year. Let's break some of it down. We got a big show today. Kylie McDaniel is going to join us around 10:50, break down the MLB draft and the Jays ahead of the deadline here. Meg Rowley of Effectively Wild and Fangraphs will join us around 11:30. And right now, to my left is producer extraordinaire at Sportsnet, at Down to Black on Twitter. It's Chris Black. Chris, how are we doing?
I made it on time. It's always a race to the studio for a 10 a.m. hit, but I love being here. How is Carlos Feblas doing? What happened? So when did this happen?
He felt a pop in his knee, and Gil Kim took over the third base duties midway through that game. He is day-to-day, and then John Schneider half-jokingly called it bilateral hamstring tightness or something like that.
I must have been watching exhibition basketball at that point.
Yeah, before we do baseball, do you want a moment of Joel Embiid slander here?
Always. Well, the only person who enjoys Embiid slander more than me is Michael Grange. But, I'll be quick on this, but, like, he doesn't fit with that team or FIBA basketball. Like, real, I get it. He's like a top 10 player in the world, so I get it. But like, Chet Holmgren would have just seamlessly fit into that group and like pick and pop, shoot threes, like don't need the ball. And like, it just, everything slow. I don't know. It's one game. I get it. But yeah, not enjoying Joel Embiid play basketball is like a fun pastime for Raptor fans.
Yeah, it's not exclusive to Raptors fans either. This is non-76ers fans in general is the impression that I get on Twitter and having covered the NBA a while. The biggest thing that stood out with respect to Embiid is like the game is called differently
exactly. In
FIBA. And FIBA refs have a lot of problems and they'll miss some stuff and things like that. But the foul baiting stuff is not something that they're going to give you, even if you're a physically dominant player. You're going to have to get fouled to get those whistles.
Yeah, no, I love that about FIBA basketball. I love the pace of it. I love how fast it moves. I love the ball goes out of bounds, it's right back in right away. And the NBA's like really adopted some of those things. But yeah, I don't know. What else did you take away from that game?
Yeah, there wasn't a ton, man. No. Nobody played more than 20 minutes. Cool moment for the scrubs and Edgem and Capengelly to get to play against that USA team toward the end there. My old G League pal, Nigel Hayes, getting some minutes at the end of that game for Team USA. I'm very curious to see what the rotation looks like in the July 19th and July 21st exhibitions that Canada has against France and Puerto Rico. Just to see, you know, I had some... If yesterday for the first three quarters is the rotation they run in the Olympics, I will raise my hand and be like, okay, that's not great. But it was the first exhibition. And so I don't know. They did a good job creating looks. They didn't knock a lot of shots down. They're obviously undersized, and that's going to be most notable
against the U.S. SGA looked very good.
Yeah.
Arriving, I don't even mean on the court.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know, in that
walking,
jumpsuit. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So SGA, it's just going to be a fun summer of watching. Those three group stage games are going to be so good, and we can nerd out on this. We could call Dan Shulman up and nerd
when
out
Joe
about
Siddle,
this.
For... Joe Siddle set Shulman up last night on the broadcast with a question about Canada basketball. I didn't know if we would get the Jays game back.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is great. Let's talk about that Jays game. So they win 10-6. Chris Bassitt really struggles over the first two innings. So 62 pitches over the first two, and then manages to give them five. As he does, three earned runs. So not his best start, but when you need 62 pitches to get through the first two innings and you can still give some length, great. From there, you know, bullpen, whatever. Bowden Francis got to stop hanging pitches for solo home runs and low leverage. On the offensive side, probably the biggest note. There was a cool thing in the sixth inning. They had six hits in a row, which I don't know if they've done this year. They had seven overall in that inning to score six runs. That was fun. But the highlight item on the offensive side for me was for the second game in a row, Ernie Clement hit a three-run home run. And these are not hey, bad pitchers grooved fastballs over the plate where Ernie Clement normally eats. The Ryan Walker one, he never allows even hits to righties when he gets the two straight counts. And then Logan Webb, Ernie Clement said after the game, got to be all the golf I've been playing lately, given that he quite literally golfed that one out, a changeup low. What did you make of Ernie's two home runs here? Because they're quite uncharacteristic for the Ernie Clement profile that we talked about last time you were on.
Yeah, a couple days ago, or up until Tuesday, he had 8 career home runs, and 7 of them were fastballs. So in the last 2 days, he hit his first ever home run on a slider. And yesterday, he hit his first ever home run off a changeup. So is this just random circumstance? Is this something approach-based? It seems like I think in order to drive a pitch that's not a fastball, you need to be somewhat timed up for it. Sometimes it's just about catching a breaking ball out front. But that swing on that changeup, that was not a, like, looking fastball and reacting. I don't think you can hit a Logan Webb changeup that well.
I mean, literally nobody has hit a Logan Webb changeup below the zone like that well.
Yeah, like, so the first thing, like, when I saw that, I did something like this. I think it was Vladimir Guerrero Jr.'s rookie year where he hit a pitch. He hit a Zach Britton sinker. This would have been maybe in the first couple months of his career. It was down below the zone, and Vladdy hit, like, a 2-iron home run to center field. And I was like, I don't know if I've ever seen anyone hit a ball like that from Zach Britton before. And when you looked, this is the best part about Savant, StatCast, all that stuff. If you pulled up all of Zach Britton's sinkers that were down below the zone, he'd never given up a home run that low. So when I saw Clement's home run last night, I said, this feels a little bit like the Zach Britton sinker thing. And sure enough, Logan Webb, great changeup. It's a really good pitch. He had thrown about 1,200 changeups down below the zone.
So
just a few in his career, and had never given up a home run. So, like, that pitch was less than a foot off the ground. Just really, really impressive. And again, like, these are in the midst of a lost season for the team as a whole. Like, these are the kind of things you can take a bit of, like, hey, maybe we can build off this. And if Ernie Clement isn't just a one-dimensional hitter, like you said last time we talked about, like, when you're a temporary player, part-time player, you kind of need a simple approach. Maybe this shows, is there another side? Is there another level that Clement can get to? Who knows? But that changeup was impressive.
Yeah, and look, that's going to be a lot of the conversation in August and September is what in everything that's going on over 2 months of baseball that won't matter a ton for the standings could potentially matter. Can a part-time guy become more of a regular guy because he changes something at the plate? Can a pitcher add another pitch? I know everyone wants to talk trades and stuff now, but there will be 2 more months of baseball where we can look at that stuff. I'm glad you brought up Zach Britton. That is one of my favorite Zach Britton memories. First is the time he didn't pitch.
Yes.
And then tied for second is a bunch of other things with Zach Britton. Ernie Clement, by the way, more home runs than Bo Bichette now on the season. 6-4.
Clement, like, if the weird thing about it is, like, we all view him as a reserve role guy. What else can he really do? He has some limitations. But, like, if you look, he can hit. He's shown an ability to hit. And now there's as we just said, like, there's an upper limit to what he's shown he can do. And I think there's an upper limit to what you can do as any big league hitter if you chase and swing so much. But again, he also hasn't gotten a lot of playing time. So can that change? Is that something? I still think, you know, I don't think you want him as a starter in 2025, but as a utility player, I don't think he's a 13th guy. I think he can be a valuable, you know, first or second, like, super utility guy.
And, I mean, finding that at the minimum with some control is important. And, you know, if you can OPS 700, 725, man the short side of a platoon and bounce around defensively, that has value. And Isaiah Kiner-Falefa has worked out, so I use this only as a contract-type example, but that saves you money from having to go and spend on a utility piece if you've found and developed that at home. Okay, so I took the little bit of a jab there at Bo, only 4 home runs here. The slump continues with Bo Bichette here, 0-for-1 last night before coming out of that game with the calf soreness. So obviously the calf soreness will dictate some things. San Francisco fans were making a lot of non-quotes yesterday from Bo, kind of, but about potential trade stuff. The thing that was most interesting to me, and this is a quote he gave Susan Slusser in the San Francisco Chronicle, was, you know, she kind of broached, I think, the like, hey, would a change of scenery, a new set of eyes kind of help? And he was basically like, well, I've always figured it out. If there was a solution, like if there was a way to figure this out, I would have figured it out by now. And it seemed to me he's a little bit, maybe a little bit at a loss. What are you seeing at this? I know we've talked about Bo, but I know you had more thoughts on just how kind of long this has extended now.
Yeah, the extended slump is really, like, it's more than a season, or more than this season. It's dating back almost a full calendar year at this point. Before we get into any, like quantitative stuff or, like, analytics stuff, like, I think just watching him, observing him from afar during these broadcasts, like, and he's always someone I hesitate to read too much into this because he's always someone where it's tough to read any kind of body language stuff. He's quiet, he's reserved, and I don't want to, you know, ding him for that. But just at the plate, there seems to be a level of frustration. Like, and this is kind of baseball as well. Like, when things aren't going good, it almost seems like you're more likely, like, an ump is going to kind of burn you on strike calls more often than not. I mean, it always feels like he's with two strikes, but even lately, it feels like almost every count is 0-2. That last at-bat, or was it his only at-bat yesterday? But, like, that at-bat that he struck out on, like, that swing he struck out on the fastball, he looked, you know, a foot behind or a foot late when he struck out. So, again, is that the calf? Is that something else? Like, body language, just things really aren't going well for him, and, like, that kind of stands out. To me, we talked about Bo maybe a month or a couple weeks ago, and we talked a little bit about how, you know, two strike approach versus before two strikes, that kind of stood out. The big thing for me is, like, I think Justin Morneau told me something start of this year or around the start of this year when we briefly saw each other, where he said he thinks, and he would know, he talks to way more big league hitters than I do, but he said something really that made me kind of stop and think and, like, take a step back and go, that makes a lot of sense. Like, he said he thinks a lot of hitters right now are struggling with the idea that there are no predictable counts, that there's nothing that you can kind of set and prepare yourself for. There's nothing you can ambush. There's nothing like...
Okay, 2-0, I'm used to getting a fastball here. That's not the case anymore. Too many guys throw multiple fastballs or throw a breaking ball for a strike in that count.
Yeah,
that
or kind of I know at some point in, like, in my two or three plate appearances against starting pitcher X that, you know, first or second pitch of an at-bat, I'm getting a hanging breaking ball, or I'm getting a fastball on the inner half. Like, that doesn't exist anymore. Like, and is that good scouting? Like, I think part of pitching now is just being unpredictable. Like, it's not just leaning on it, going up against a hitter's weaknesses, or leaning into your own strengths. Part of it is just like, hey, in the three times I face this hitter, I am not going to be I'm not going to repeat anything in terms of a sequence or a locate, like, just being unpredictable.
Like, the pitch comms just set the random.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that would be incredibly, I've always said hitting is incredibly hard. You know, the fact, and I can't remember if it was you or if it was somebody else that said this, but I think it lands well. And I think, like, The pitchers get the first move, right? And, like, you're a hitter is almost always on defense, right? And it's just, I think hitting's gone incredibly, incredibly hard, where it's just, you know, it's 99 guys coming out. Like, there's a Giants reliever, I can't remember if it was the first game or second game of the series, but, like, middle of the game, fifth inning, sixth inning, and he comes in and it's a guy throwing 99. And it's just like, okay, like, is that, that's just everyone now. They grow on trees, right? So I don't know. Like, it's a long-winded way for Bo of being like, I think he got a lot of runway and found a lot of productivity in his best years of ambushing certain things and going after certain things. And I think that's kind of gone away, and he's trying to find a new normal. And there are all sorts of other things that I have no idea what's going on, health-wise and approach, who knows what else. But I think he might be a really good example for what Justin Morneau told me, like, a couple months ago.
And then, in addition to a fifth inning guy who throws 98, 99, there's Sean Gelli, who is 6'11" and should be replacing Joel Embiid on the USA basketball team, not playing baseball. What are you doing playing baseball at 6'11"? Sean Jelly. Okay, yeah, and one last note on the count predictability there. I think it was when we were prepping Red Sox and Brian Baio. Sinker, changeup, slider, and he threw them basically 33%, 33%, 33% when there's two strikes. Like, it's almost entirely just like, okay, yes.
Yeah, like, I think that's a really good way of putting it, that, like, and even, like, guys who are fastball, like, in one of their, whatever their best secondary pitch is, like, you know, conventional wisdom used to be 60-40 or 65-35, something like that. I think, you know, Paul Skeens and guys like that are showing us, no matter how good your fastball is, it's probably at its best if you're throwing it like 45 to 50% of the time.
Yeah, unless you've got multiple fastballs and then we're talking about, you know, sinker cutter together or something like
that. Yeah, but I think it would be harder than ever to be a big league hitter. And there are people who know more about this stuff than I do that might have a different opinion, but it just seems to me like every time I watch a game, I'm just like, oh man, this looks really hard.
And it does seem to be the crux. The Athletic had a big series, a week-long series the other week about just how hard hitting has gotten and how, you know, whether it's, you know, game theory-wise, pitchers move first. Technologically, the pitching stuff is ahead of the hitting stuff. Yeah, there's just a lot going on to harm hitters, and that's why league-wide OPS is like 700 in addition to, you know, theories about the baseball and the climate change and things like that. Another guy who's had a lot of trouble hitting of late, let's just stick with guys who left injured yesterday, conversations that we might not get to have the next 2 weeks if they're hurt. Dalton Varsho, since May 27th, that's 36 games, 130 plate appearances. He has one home run, 38 strikeouts to 12 walks, and a 557 OPS. Since that one home run, which was back on June 16th, he has a 337 OPS. I know you broke that down in a thread recently. What are you seeing inside Dalton Varsho's struggles? This is not quite a Bo Bichette length, but a pretty, like, 337 over almost a month here, 557 over almost 2 months here is pretty extreme.
Yeah, so there was a moment, I worked a homestand in mid-June, Cleveland, Boston. He hit a big grand slam, kind of clinched the game for him as midway through the game. And it was a grand slam. Right after he hit that, his OPS was 766, and he was top 30 in baseball in wins above replacement by position players. And we're talking like he was like a decimal point behind Adley Rutschman and Fernando Tatis. Like, you know, it was everything that, you know, when we talked about Dalton Varsho before the year began, it was everything that we were talking about in terms of like best possible outcomes, that the defense remains best in the league, base running remains good, and can he be a good enough hitter to where his value becomes what we all think it could be? And it was. But since that, like, as you mentioned, went, like, has fallen off a cliff. I did a thread on Dalton before the year began, and one of the strange things, if you looked at kind of pitch locations and where he struggled last year, the up in the zone was always, like, something we all noticed, but something we didn't notice was in. He was just struggling with a lot of fastballs in, and it didn't make sense for a guy with his bat speed and for a guy who wanted to pull the ball as much as he did. So I always thought like that would be something that would normalize. Like, my working theory on it was there was just something where, like, was he a little too jumpy in his first year? Was he, you know, when he saw an inside fastball, was he just being like way too eager to go get it and foul off a ball, like 40 feet foul to right field? So that has normalized. We saw that normalize. He was pounding pitches on the inner half to start the year. Now, what has happened is always like where I thought his natural hole in his swing kind of lied was teams now are just working him away, 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 away. And if you look, like if you break a strike zone into nine boxes, you know, a 3x3 box, those three boxes on the outside, on the outer third, he's like the worst or second worst among the worst in terms of least productive left-handed hitters in baseball for pitches in those areas. And everywhere else, he's like a top 30 hitter. So it's just, it's become, and like, again, like this is where we're talking about how good pitching has gone. Like, I think personally, advanced scouting has gotten better in terms of like teams pick up on these holes quicker than ever. Like, whereas like maybe the adjustments that the league and a hitter or a pitcher, like the back and forth used to take longer. I think data has just like exponentially, you know, sped up those adjustments. And like, I think it doesn't take long for teams to see like, hey, you can have success working this guy away, or in Dalton's case, like up and away has been a real particular spot where teams are working him. So I think he has to show that he's willing to do something more than just give us your best bat speed and pull the ball. Cause I don't think he can be what we saw from him, you know, be that 750 OPS guy if it's going to be this all or nothing, you know, one size fits all approach.
And it's an interesting dynamic because, you know, you come into the season with a weakness, and that weakness is related to you getting to your best possible version of yourself, which is turning on a lot of inside stuff.
Exactly.
With pull power. And then you're the most pull heavy guy, arguably, in the entire league. And then, yeah, obviously pitchers are going to adjust. And, you know, even the best hitters, like obviously you could slow your swing down and, you know, cover more of the plate. But if your swing is designed to sell out for pull power, it's going to be hard for you to cover something high and away with any sort of authority other than kind of flick it away. Now, there are things that you can do to adjust that. You could, you know, one way would be to not maximize that one strength. And that's an interesting thing of like, do you focus on what you do best or do you try to do everything? That's something Danny Jansen struggled with at times in his career and has kind of settled in as I'm going to pull a lot of stuff and that's going to be my profile. And I know Jansen gets compared to Isak Paredes a lot because Paredes is kind of the face of the, well, just pull it in the air revolution. And this has happened to him too. He has started to get pitched more and more on the outside. Yep. And he's done two things to try to combat this. One is he basically stands on top of the plate, which is, you know, that's a risk. There are some opportunities for pitchers to then come and jam you inside and you won't be able to turn on it because you're just too close to the plate. But so far, so good in his case. And the other thing is, when he gets the two strikes, he is not the Isak Paredes that makes all the charts that go on Twitter and stuff like that about pulled fly balls. He becomes, you know, slows the bat speed down a little bit, tries to use more fields. Is that something you think Dalton Varsho could also try to do? Hey, maybe until two strikes, you can still look for that pull side power, but it's that two strike approach that maybe needs to shift a little bit.
100%. Like, I think, like, a real simple way of looking at hitting to me is like, before there's two strikes, it kind of belongs to you.
Do your thing.
You do your thing. Do swing however you want, pull, like hit the ball wherever you want, do whatever you think puts you in the best position to succeed. Two strikes, you got to change it. And you hit the nail on the head with Paredes. Like, I think a lot of modern baseball fans, like, we all view Paredes as this like god of pulling the baseball, but I think the numbers show he does different things with two strikes. And so not just the numbers, like if you just look at clips, like the clips show he swings different. He's more willing to put the ball the other way. So I think there's an interesting way of when bat tracking came in this year, kind of early this season, and Statcast and Savant, one of the ways they show kind of graphically illustrate people's swings.
The spread.
Like a distribution of how fast you're swinging, right? And it's like most of them, if you look at it, certain players, they just look like your standard, not to get, well, I'm nerdy almost all the time when talking about baseball, but like to get really nerdy for, you know, 30 seconds, you know, most of them look like a standard bell curve, like a standard distribution bell curve. Paredes, and if you look at Dalton Varsho's, it is like, it's most of his swings are all one kind of swing, right? If you look at Paredes, he's got a little like, there's a little plateau before he gets to his best bat speeds. And to me, I would guess that those are his two strike, that little plateau of lesser bat speeds, those are two strike swings, right? Like, I think he's more willing to change his approach. And I think like that's what you need to do. What you talked about, like sitting on the plate, like I think the other thing you can do if you're getting worked away, like what you alluded to, is like, if I really think or I'm really betting on this particular pitcher or this particular team is going to work me away, then do what you do. Then do what you mentioned. Sorry, like sit on the plate and treat that outside pitch just like a pitch right over the plate, right? So there's some ambushing involved there. But yeah, like I think there's a lot that Varsho can learn from Paredes. I think, you know, bat speed, it's not everything. When this stuff first came out, you and I had the conversation of like, you know, bat speed isn't everything, just like pitch velocity isn't everything. But all other things being equal, I'll take better bat speed than less bat speed. And like, that's why I'm still encouraged by Dalton Varsho, because He has really good bat speed. Same with George Springer, right? Like, as bad as the George Springer season was going to start the year, like, the bat speed was there.
And it's ticked up month by month,
and it's
which
ticked
is something
up,
we can
like,
now
right?
see.
So, like, there were reasons to believe. Like, I believe in stuff like bat speed. I believe in stuff like pitch velocity, right? Like, so there's a baseline weapon there. He's just got to, you know, is this something that he can really work on in season, developing that kind of B swing? I don't know. I think that's incredibly hard. We've just spent, like, 15 minutes talking about how incredibly hard pitching is. I think it's really hard to kind of to implement that in season. But, yeah, like, you know, I started this Dalton Varsho kind of conversation with, like, saying on June 15th, so 2.5 months into the year, he was a top 30 player in baseball. It's been really, it really hasn't gone well since then. It's dropped him down. But, like, I still believe, like, that's what he should and can be, right, with the right approach and maybe a less kind of all-in approach.
And he's going to be walking around like Owen Hart with two slammies, carrying two gold gloves at the end of the year, one for left, one for center. A reference you probably don't get, but some people might appreciate. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take a look at Kevin Gausman's pretty extreme home road splits and what's actually going on underneath that as we set up the series finale today down in San Fran. Chris Black staying with us for a few more minutes as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Chris Black still alongside me. Jays and Giants evened up at one apiece here. They'll close out the series at 3:45 on Sportsnet. Kevin Gausman against Jordan Hicks. I'll be on Blue Jay Central for a little bit with Brad and Madison. That is something Chris Black will be producing. He stays with us here. Give us a little spoiler here, man. Kevin Gausman, there's been a lot of talks of splits with Kevin Gausman, and there are lefty-righty splits that we don't expect Kevin Gausman to have as much as other pitchers because the splitter is platoon neutral-ish. However, there is also this enormous home road split when it comes to Kevin Gausman. Does he just hate Toronto, Chris?
Let me preface all this quick conversation with this first point. Like, I really generally do not like home road splits. Like, I don't like the conversation.
So noisy.
Like, most of the time, I don't think it tells you anything. Unless you play for the Colorado Rockies or a super pitcher friendly, like the San
and
Francisco
Giants.
And if you
play Giants, for the Colorado Rockies, they don't even have enough of an analytics department to give you home road splits.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, that's the, like, first point is that generally speaking, I really don't think there's much to be gleaned from home road stuff. And when these things pop up, I usually go, okay, well, what else is going on? Is there something else going on, or is it just noise? Is there a simpler explanation?
And the example that people should remember of this one, I forget which season, but there was a year where Drew Hutchison was like the Cy Young winner and then the worst pitcher in baseball, like depending on where he was pitching. I forget. I want to say it was 2014 or 2015, but they were like the most extreme home road splits, and there was nothing underneath it whatsoever.
Yeah, like sometimes it's just random. Sometimes it doesn't make sense. But also, like, if that is the case, we're still not learning anything from it.
Ooh, here it is. So it was what year am I on here? I am on 2015, and
it was a weird season. Just Drew Hutchison overall, it was a weird season.
He was 11-2 with a 291 at home, and 2-3 with a 983 on the road, and never replicated in any other season. There was nothing underlying it. Like, not even like he walked a couple more guys on the road, and that's about it.
Hmm. So, like, with Gausman, there is something underlying. There is something, like, really straightforward where it's just, you know, to really simplify it, he's faced really good hitting teams at home and he's faced really bad hitting teams on the road. And, like, literally that's all it is, you know, done and dusted, like, close the door, go home. Like, there's nothing to be gleaned from this other than, like, here are some of the teams he's faced at home. The Orioles, who are first in the league in runs per game. Yankees, twice he's faced them. They're second. Dodgers, third. Twins, fifth. Guardians, sixth. Red Sox, 11th. Here's the above-average teams he's faced on the road. Yankees, Red Sox, and Royals. That's it. And he's faced, like, the White Sox, the A's, the Mariners, the Rays, the Tigers, and the Nationals on the road. So it's just, like, we could dive into this. We could talk about, is there something else going on? And we could, but like, it's just he's faced a lot of good teams at home. So like today, if he, like the Giants are a league average offense, so they're right in the middle.
And worse against righties than lefties.
Yeah, so like, but like, it's a getaway day, so which always, to me, in my mind, lends itself to like, pitchers have the upper hand. I think umpires have, this is anecdotal, but like, I think umpires have a looser strike zone.
It's a getaway day for them too.
Yeah, getaway day for them too. So like, generally, I think getaway days favor pitchers. I think this park favors pitchers, and I think he's facing a league average offense. Not guaranteeing anything, but all I'm saying is when he, if he throws, you know, seven innings with two earned, like, let's not all dive into, whoa, he loves pitching on the road or anything like that. It is just who he is facing, in my humble opinion.
And to hear him tell it to Keegan Mathison of MLB.com after that last start does feel like he found something mechanically in that last start to help the splitter. You know, usually we think of breaking pitches. The more it breaks, the harder it breaks, the better. In his case, he wants that splitter to hold the zone a little bit more before he breaks. And he does feel so, he figured something out there. So that could be a part of it as well, and it won't be a home road thing.
Yeah, and I don't question Kevin Gausman's belief that he found something. All I would say is I think it's probably easier for a big league pitcher to find something when facing the Seattle Mariners as opposed to facing the Baltimore Orioles or New York Yankees.
Yeah, the Seattle Mariners, who had three consecutive innings with the bases loaded in an extra inning game and couldn't find a hit.
Yeah.
By the way, I looked up, and this is something we're going to talk with Mike Riley about later, but I looked up the Mariners' high leverage offensive stats because they were abhorrent in that series against the Blue Jays. They're like third in the league in high leverage offense production. It's crazy. That weekend was just like a monster outlier for them. Yeah, it's very.
So they have really bad offense, but good in leverage.
Yes, it was, which is almost entirely, like random. Almost certainly just random. Okay, so the Blue Jays, even if Kevin Gausman's better, even if Dalton Varsho figures it out, even if Bo Bichette's not hurt, probably going to sell by July 30th because they are eight games under 500 and 8.5 back of a playoff spot. Most of what we've heard is that this team is going to sell with an eye toward being competitive again in 2025, which is different than selling with the idea of tearing everything down and looking deep into the future. You think that's something we should keep front of mind as we go through these trade deadline discussions and hypotheticals? Can you walk me through a little bit of why you think we need to be careful about the seller's mentality with the Blue Jays this year?
Some people are reacting to like what they're saying. Like there are a few reports over the last few days about how they're not, you know, not planning to move anyone under contract further than this season. You know, my response to that, to any like consternation about that, is that's what anyone would say. Like you want to induce.
You ever been in a fantasy league?
Yeah, like you want to induce your best offers. So regardless of whether or not they do it or whether or not they even want to do it, like that is what you're going, that is what all GMs are going to say about their players under contract, because you, in the only way you induce your best offers is by saying you're not going to move them. So that's, you know, that's point number one. Point number two to me is like, I do think you're kind of bound by the roster. Like baseball, it's not a basketball roster. It's 26 guys. Like, and you need to, like, they, you can't tear down everything. You can't, and they're just kind of bound by the players they have. Like, this will sound silly for a team that's eight games under, but like heading into 2025, they have too many players under contract who are, you know, who should be above average major league players, pitchers, hitters, whatever. So like, I do think the likeliest scenario, again, not debating the merits of either, but I do think the likeliest scenario is they do some version of running it back or competing for a playoff spot next year. And so if you're keeping that as like assumption or point number two, to me, it's about finding teams who have, who aren't necessarily the best farm systems, because the best farm systems quite often are like ones loaded with single A, high A, some double A talent. I think you want to focus on teams that have, you know, 25-year-olds, 26-year-olds, triple A, kind of deep 40-mans, teams like that. And to me, the team that stands out way above anyone else is the Dodgers. Like with their injury problems, with starting pitching concerns, with middle infield concerns, like, and I don't think that's necessarily trading a bow, but like, I just think they have so many guys. They have the deepest 40 man in the league, and I don't think it's particularly close. Like, I think they can be a team that could, you know, I think they have lots of pieces that aren't going to help them win a title in 2024 that could help a good baseball team in 2025. So to me, like, I would literally be focusing on that one team if I could find pieces that they wanted.
Also fascinating that the Dodgers have the deepest 40-man because they have eight guys on the 60-day IL. So it's really a 48-man.
Yeah.
There's two ways to do a deep 40-man. There's the Rays where you're constantly just DFAing guys and claiming new waiver guys, so it feels like you've got a million. Or you're the Dodgers where a third of your roster is on the long-term IL, another third of your roster is on the short-term IL, and you're still, like, the best team in the league.
They're so deep. They're an amazing organization. But, like, it seems like they'd be in on Kikuchi. Like, I think it makes sense.
They just sent Bobby Miller down to the minors. And I know none of the smart pitching analysts can figure out why
exactly
it hasn't worked for him. But, like, if you're a World Series contender, right now you have in your rotation Landon Knack, Gavin Stone, and Justin Wroblewski, who are, like, nice-ish prospects, and a couple of them are pitching pretty well. But you've got Glasnow, who you can probably think is going to come back, but he has never been particularly durable. Kershaw, who's had his rehab stopped and start. Walker Buehler, who is on his way back. But again, Yamamoto, who we don't really have a timeline on. Dustin May, his surgery was July last year, so maybe he's a late season consideration. This is a lot of, like, down the line maybes. Like, even if those guys get back, you know, none of them are, hey, seven innings locked in every single time.
Yeah, like, I honestly think, like, Kikuchi to the Dodgers makes perfect sense. And, like, I would find a way, whether it's throwing in another major league piece or even, like, not prospect for prospect, but, like, adding somebody. Do you, like, get creative in terms of, is it Kikuchi and some low A prospect on your side going there to get, like, a high-end 2025 piece, whether that is a Bobby Miller.
The inverse of the Mitch White trade where they got Alex DeJesus back to give up Nick Frasso.
Yeah, like, well, that's an interesting name to me. Like I don't know that Nick, I know he's, like, he had surgery and, you know, would he move again? But, like, I would be targeting names like Nick Frasso and Bobby Miller. And, like, I don't know whether they would move. Who knows? But, like, that's the kind of creativity. That's the kind of, like, angle or, like, talent I'd be looking for in every trade I made was, like, even if I'm getting rid of some low-A talent, something like that, and major league talent to get me better 2025 talent, that's the way I would be approaching this deadline if I was a team in the position of the Blue Jays that are kind of – they're not a unique rebuilding team, right? They are a unique team that's selling at the deadline, where most of the teams that are out of it at this point, they are not competing next year. Again, that can send us down another road. But, like, I just think it seems like if they want to compete, it brings a unique set of circumstances in terms of how they approach this deadline.
Yeah, and who knows? You're going to need players, like you said, you're going to need players to, it's a deep roster, you can't sell everyone, you need players to plug in. Maybe you can get Kevin Biggio back in the deal. I think they probably...
I'm a Biggio stan, so...
Yeah, the Dodgers fans are not so far. It's been a tough... He did homer the other day. Homer as a Dodger, but yeah, he's been already worth a negative 0.2 wins above replacement in only 43.
Do you think they'll move? Do you think the Jays will move anyone that's under contract past 24?
I do. I think, I would be pretty surprised at this point if it's a Bo or Vlad level thing. But I think the starting pitching market is thin enough that I think teams would be smart to call on Chris Bassett. I don't know what the Jays' willingness to move off of him would be, but I would imagine they're getting calls on him.
I think teams will call. Will they make it worthwhile for the Jays to move him?
So the one guy I'm like, it mentally, I have included him in the expirings is Chad Green. I know he's not expiring, but $10.5 million for next year, a veteran guy who's pitched in the playoffs, pitched in big moments, big markets and stuff like that. Like, I think a team, it would have to be a higher budget team to take on that $10.5 million for next year. And it's not the end of the world if you bring him back, but I would not be surprised if he is.
So you're
a guy.
Just building a brand new bullpen for 2025.
I mean, does it really feel that much different?
No, it's one guy, but yeah.
Yeah.
There's going to be they're going to have a lot of work to do there.
Yeah. They've got a lot of work to do in general for 2025 and moving forward. Let's take a break. Let's tag in Kylie McDaniel, see what he thinks of the state of the Blue Jays. He was pretty blunt about it last time we talked to him about a month ago. We'll talk about that. We'll tee up this weekend's MLB draft with him as well. Kylie McDaniel joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win last night, 10-6. Ernie Clement, 3-run home run, 6 hits in a row in the 6th inning for the Jays as they put up 6 runs in that one. Chris Bassett labors, but manages to give them 5. And then a funny Matt Chapman game. You want guys to do well after they leave here. I enjoyed the Matt Chapman experience. But if you were a Blue Jays fan who remembered him having some struggles in high leverage, which the stats back up over his time here, he had runners on the corners with 1 out yesterday, struck out. He had the bases loaded with 2 out, popped out in the infield. He had 1 on with 1 out, flew out. He had the bases loaded with 2 out, flew out. And then once they were down 5, bases empty, end of the game, he homered. So the lowest leverage of homers off of Bowden Francis thereafter. A couple big opportunities missed earlier in that game. Kevin Gausman against Jordan Hicks. Today it's a 3:45 start, so we'll have that for you on Sportsnet. We will get you set up for that throughout this second hour here. It's also the Major League Baseball draft this weekend. We will have Shane Farrell, the Blue Jays scouting director, on the show tomorrow to pick his brain on some of this, talk about the Blue Jays process and things like that. But right now, let's go to ESPN. Let's talk to Kylie McDaniel, who has been in several front offices for this time of year, for lots of time of year, and he's been just putting in work on the draft front, man. How you doing? How does this week feel for you?
Busy. I usually don't have my day in like the, you know, using all the things in Google and calendar to be like, well, for this 30 minutes I'm doing this and the next 30 minutes I'm doing that. My day is usually a little more freeform, like write this thing and make a few phone calls. And this week it's been a lot of like this one to that one to this one to that one. I don't know. I kind of asked for it, but that, yeah, it's been a little different.
And here you are. We appreciate you making time out for us. Always a good chat. I'd imagine, so of all the things you do, and like obviously you choose this line of work because you love baseball and you like doing the prospect stuff and you've written books on it, future value and all that. But also this week you got to sit in judgment of Jeff Passan and a couple of your other colleagues at ESPN. They kind of did their prospect super teams and you got to judge them. How fun was that for you to kind of just be like, guys, come on.
Well, it's funny because every time we do it, I think we've done it 3 or 4 times now, I am busy that day. And so I just open my phone and there's an email chain with like 32 emails in it. And so I get to open it up fresh and just see what happened and be like, oh boy, like technically what they should be doing is just copying my rankings. But the way we always time it is it comes out the day or the day after of my rankings. So my rankings are updated and they're not public yet. And so the guys that are drafting don't know how I'm going to judge them, which is basically how close did you hew to my rankings? And, oh, this is the area where these 3 guys are all the same, but this part of the draft, these guys are very different. And Jeff's much better at that than I think the other 2 guys are. And Jeff and I talk about the draft, and I don't really talk to the other 2 guys about the draft because, you know, they don't really care very much. So Jesse Rogers asked me before I saw the email chain to say, hey, take it easy on me this year. He was like, I talked to a scouting director, and he said this guy might be really good. I was like, yeah, no, I know he might be.
that's really funny. And they're, I mean, following your rankings is funny. Like, I don't know, I play in a fantasy league with Eno Saris. And it's like, well, if I just follow his rankings, that's probably the smart thing to do. But I don't want to do that. I might actually go against his rankings because I can see them. You don't want to stick to them too much because then you're like the guy who's like after the draft, like, oh, Yahoo or ESPN gave me an A+ for my draft. Yeah, man, because you just drafted whoever was ranked the highest. You didn't do anything on your own. But obviously we put a lot of value in your rankings. How much of this, when you're putting out, so for anyone who didn't see at ESPN, you have your updated top 250 for this draft broken down to, hey, these are 60 grade future value guys, 55, 50, et cetera, and have them tiered like that. How much of this is, you know, stats versus your own scouting eye on them versus talking to front office and scout execs? Like what goes into your final ranking here?
Yeah, it's a mix of all of them. So like when it comes to college players, I get a you know, we'll call it private, it's not technically public, sheet of TrackMan information. So I could see, you know, fastball shapes and induced vertical break and approach angle and all the exit velos. And there is a, and this is only like the Power Five schools really get it, because it's at like 60, 65 schools. So a lot of the mid-majors will play, you know, 10 games on a TrackMan unit. So that data is kind of useless. So with the college guys, I can be sort of data influenced in that way to say, okay, I have like some algorithms, pretty simple, maybe formulas would be the better word for it, to sort of turn it into scouting grades. So I can be like, oh, using sort of Z-scores, this guy's 90th percentile exit velo suggests that his power is blank. I watched him take BP. I looked at his swing. He has to change his swing. His BP is this. I can adjust, you know, up or down, or he's in a band box, or there's rumors they're loading the bats up there. There's all kinds of little things you can sort of add into it. So with the college guys, I kind of start with, well, I have, you know, nominally 3 years of history with them, whether I've been like paying so close attention or they've been big prospects or not. And then you layer on this level of the TrackMan data, which, you know, second half of the season, I have that stuff. And so you could say, okay, so the data is going to say this. Usually I've seen them at some level this year, whether it's on TV or in person. And so then I can go through my notes and be like, you know, the data says it's a plus slider. I think it's a 50. Like, what am I missing here? And you can kind of dive into it. And it's a similar process to what you do with a minor leaguer, where usually there are, you know, maybe 10, 20% of the population of players you're looking at where there is like an actual disconnect between what the data says and then what the scouting says. And, you know, maybe if you add in like their surface stats, like there's some guys that don't walk very much but have a really good eye because they make contact with every good pitch they swing at. So they're not walking. So it seems like they don't have a good eye, but they actually do. Like there's just some examples of that where the stats will let you down. And then with the high school players, it's much more difficult because the data is not as useful. I don't have as much of it. I don't have synergy with every guy's game on video. If I do, it's in the summer. It's not in the spring. In the spring, they might only face one guy that throws 90. Hopefully, I'm there that day. Probably, I'm not. And so it's a lot more talking to people that then, you know, scouts that go to these games, the guys that have all the data and all the video and have all the summer stats and all sorts of things to sort of like fill in the holes I have. We're like, oh, I saw this guy three times in the summer and he didn't hit. And you guys are telling me he has the best summer stats out of everybody. I was underrating him because I got him on bad days and assumed that was representative. And turns out it wasn't. Or everybody told me at the beginning of the spring, this guy wasn't very good. And then he had a really good spring, but I wasn't there one of those days. So especially when you're ranking 250, you're considering about, you know, 500 guys. And so there's going to be holes. And then you basically have to then send around the rankings and be like, okay, what am I missing here? Like what guy will I be embarrassed by having in a certain spot, and hope that the answer is not, oh, well, we really like this guy. We want to draft him. We want you to have him low. Hope that they're, you know, incentivized to be honest as well. So the reason that was a long meandering answer is this is a long meandering process.
It sounds that way, but it's a valuable one. And then the tough part for you is, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to print that out and I'm going to, if they're not ranked 1 to 250 exactly by who has wins above replacement 1 through 250, hell to pay, yeah. Man. Okay. So you've done obviously a ton of work. You tier these guys, Condon and Bazana are the only guys you put in the 60 future value tier. So on that 2080, scale, so having two guys in the 60 tier and then 10 guys who are 50, 55, or 60 overall, where does that put the quality of this draft class at the top?
So coming into this spring, there were no 60s and I think no 55s. And wow, those numbers typically rise throughout the year because, you know, the college players are, instead of being 19 or 20-year-old sophomores, they're now 20 to 21-year-old juniors. So the performance will get better. They will look better comparatively. They have an extra year to prove themselves. So the numbers tend to rise over time. But we thought after last year's top five was like a historic top five. There were five dudes that were going to go, if they weren't all 60s on draft day, they probably were very close to it. They all went in the top 25 prospects in baseball immediately, which is kind of the 60 FV tier, is 20 to 25 players, depending on the year. This year we have two, but there's three guys that are like maybe within the top 50, like in that 25 to 50 area of the pro top 100. So like we had a historic group last year. You had Skeens and Langford rush straight to the big leagues. Walker Jenkins has been better than expected. And then I'd say Max Clark has held expectations. Cruz has maybe been a little bit worse, but basically the same. So we had five guys, historic group. Three of them are much better than we thought they were. And then the other two are still pretty good. This year, these guys got much better through the spring. We have two guys in Condon and Bazana that fit with that group of five. And then three guys that are just behind them. So to answer your question, it's pretty close to a historic group, even though we thought it was going to be a bad group. And you could argue that the top 10 as a whole is actually better than last year's top 10. The limitation is actually that like 11 to 25 area. Last year, there was a disproportionate amount of high school hitters, which are the sort of highest upside demographic. And it was like a crazy year where, I was talking to teams like, hey, in this 11 through 35 area of my rankings for last year, I'm like, there's going to be seven dudes that are on a top 100 like a year from now. We just don't know which ones they are. And it's, you know, Johnny Farmello, Aiden Miller, guys that are going in the 20s and 30s are showing up on top 100s less than a year later. This year, there's like three dudes that might be that good. And last year, there were like 12. So I think the difference is the depth of the college pitching, the depth of the high school hitting, which are the sort of high floor and high ceiling groups. Those are not as good. So I would say the top five, very good, above average. The top 10 overall, maybe even plus. And then after that, it really thins out. And I think a lot of teams see the depth of this draft as being below average because it's just a lot of flawed college hitters. And I would say sort of limited upside comparatively, high school position players. A lot of guys that are shortstops that don't have power, corner guys that, you know, can't play up the middle, that kind of thing. So I think this is a really good year to pick in that, you know, top 10 to 12. And then it's maybe not a great year or a year to go under and sort of move your money around to pick, say, 15 to 30 or have comp picks or stuff like that.
So if you're the Blue Jays picking exactly at number 20 for the second year in a row, you're probably maybe not getting someone as enticing as Arjun Namala last year, who was obviously incredibly young and is red hot at Dunedin right now. But probably, you know, on average, who they get at number 20 this year would slot in a little lower than Namala would on like a prospect ranking.
Probably, and Namal is a good example of he was the sort of high-risk, high-reward from that big group of 15 or 20 high school position players. There's not really those kinds of tools available at the draft this year, but there are very good tools from the college area, and I'm guessing your next question will be something like, who are the Jays looking at? It is mostly college position players because that is mostly what's available in that juncture. And so the key is we've talked, I feel like every time I'm on, I talk about having like a player development and scouting point of view. Like, what are we good at developing? What do we disproportionately want to scout and get in the draft, the international market, the trade market, free agency, because we think we can fix it, whether it's at the low minors or at the big leagues. If there is a point of view, a guy like, say, Seaver King at Wake Forest was playing in a D3 school for 2 years, went to Wake Forest, has a flawed but fixable swing and really big tools and had a pretty good performance. If you think you have a point of view where you can fix that guy quickly, if you fix him, he then is a top 10 guy in this draft class and could be that Colt Emerson or whoever that guy is that goes from 20 to 25 in the draft to fifth or sixth in the draft in less than a year because you just immediately stuff clicks. That guy exists and they're in the college ranks. So there could be an even bigger result because this guy's going to be 22 next year, might be in double A or triple A. There's probably one or two guys like that in the draft. And I bet one of them is on the board at 20 this year. The trick is going through this whole mess of guys and figuring out who that guy is. I don't know who it is yet. I have a feeling the Blue Jays don't. I think most teams don't. I think even the Mariners, when they took Colt Emerson, didn't know he was going to be in the top half of a top 100 that summer. That's just sort of the trick of the draft. There's, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on the line, and people still don't really know what they're doing.
And, I mean, there's also the element of, well, you don't know who that guy's going to be, but also, like, the Mariners have pretty good player development system. And I know, you know, the depth of their farm system isn't elite, but I think they had seven or eight top 100 guys and obviously have graduated a bunch as well. So that's maybe, you know, that's a little different. You got to nail the player development side as well. So that's a good snapshot of the type of quality that's available at number 20. Because this is so wide open, I'd imagine your answer to this is like, well, there's like 15 different guys I've heard connected to the Jays and things like that. Like in your 45 future value tier, that covered rankings 15 to 42. So like 30 guys could go 15th, you know? So it's hard to peg down 20th, obviously. Who do you like that could be around that range? You know, obviously we don't know who that Colt Emerson type is going to be, but who are some of the names that you could see, hey, get taken in the early 20s there, ends up looking like some value down the line?
And it'd be disrespectful and look over at my second monitor now, start pulling up some of these names. I mentioned Seaver King. I was actually at a workout for a player a couple days ago. And as I was leaving, Seaver King was coming in. So he's working on his swing currently. and I said good luck to him.
I've heard I was talking to Michael Bauman of Fangraphs yesterday who wrote a piece about him as well. And I've heard a couple times now on this show from draft people that he's just like the for as much as teams weight this stuff, the intangibles are like off the chart on a guy like Seaver King as well. Does that maybe, you know, do teams weight that kind of thing in terms of, well, hey, maybe this guy has the capacity to get better, that click or fix or whatever, because the intangible side of things is really strong as well?
Yeah, and with him, I would say even the narrative part is even more powerful, which is, like, he's from Athens, Georgia. He's an hour outside of Atlanta. I never even heard his name until this time last year because he was the big guy in the portal that every major school was going after and chose Wake Forest not because it was necessarily the most money. I don't think it was, because they're a place that develops pitchers and hitters well. And he went from unknown out of high school, small school, in college for 2 years, didn't face any good pitching. We then went to Team USA last summer and was one of the better players on the team, and then went to Wake Forest and was pretty good. And like I said, I think there's some fixable stuff in his swing, and he's only faced good pitching for like a year, and he's 21, and he's like a seven runner that might play shortstop and shows above average raw power and above average bat to ball. It's just a little rough around the edges, but he also performed in the ACC. It's not like he doesn't know what he's doing. This isn't like a Vance Honeycutt Dakota Jordan where it's like, oh, he's got some 70 and 80 grade tools, but it like might be a three bat. It's like, it's not that at all. But also, guys can look like this and like not really get out of double A. Like that happens sometimes too. So it's almost like the high school level of variance of what he is and what he could be. But also, he hit in the ACC. So it's not like you're just taking a high school guy and he's going to get released in A ball, which doesn't really happen that much anymore, but still happens sometimes. I wouldn't be worried about that. And also, I would say just the tools is this guy could be the on the 40 man. Like if he just like crashes out, the tools allow him, I would say same with Honeycutt, same with Dakota Jordan, those guys, the big tools guys that you're like, this guy might not hit, he might not be good at baseball. Those guys are probably at least defensive replacements if they're just like passable at the plate. So there is like some level of floor that you've got like a serviceable big leaguer that if you can keep him around for 4 or 5 years in the big leagues, he might figure it out because he's got big league level tools. And that is, while that may sound like cold comfort that this guy might be a usable backup, at pick 20, there's not going to be 20 everyday guys in this draft. So if at pick 20, you get a guy that's in the big leagues for 4 or 5 years and is a nice role player, there's probably one of those 20 guys will be going after your pick. So there will be technically a better pick available, but it's like perfectly fine to get a big leaguer at pick 20. You're not like expecting to get a star, as much as I know fans want to believe that. And they think of Aaron Judge or, you know, Anthony Volpe or, you know, whoever it might be that went late in the first round and turned into a dude, Gunnar Henderson. It's the same thing with the Emerson. It's like, there's like one or two of those guys in each draft. Like, it's pretty tough to guess who those guys are ahead of time. So getting a result is, you know, sometimes good. And also the people on the team usually don't get fired if they get a result.
Yeah, although you don't see the results often for a few years. And if you are a front office that is already maybe up against that question, maybe you don't get to see the fruits of whoever you draft at 20 here. So I did want to ask you about that. You were on with us about a month ago, and we kicked around some of, you know, where the Blue Jays are big picture and what the direction is going to be. Obviously, performance-wise, they're in the exact same spot. The sell or not sell conversation is fairly similar. In a recent draft piece where you asked one big question for each team heading into the draft, you said, first of all, you said, I have no idea what the long-term plan is in Toronto, which is, yes, fair, and the tone of our conversation last time you were on. But you also asked the question, will the Jays' disappointing 2024 season affect their draft approach? What did you mean by that? What's kind of on your radar in terms of, you know, when you sit down with what the Jays did over day one, day two here, how are you going to contextualize that in terms of where the Jays are in 2024?
So I have an idea of where I think the organization is on this, or organization, if you'd like to be Canadian about it. Do you look at the 2024 season and say, this is a disaster, we need to do a complete fire sale, trade everybody that's not under contract into 2026 and get all the prospects and all that sort of thing? I don't think they're going to do that. I think you could, if you take a 30,000 foot view and just look at the talent, the payroll, et cetera, there is a case to be made that should be done. I don't think that's going to happen because I think the sort of thought process of ownership is, we're spending a lot of money, we're not getting the results right now. I don't think we're that far away from getting the results. So let's, you know, do some, not necessarily cosmetic changes, but like, let's, you know, let these two guys walk and then bring in these two free agents and then make this trade and, you know, sort of tread water in a way and see if we can solve this and maybe sneak into the, you know, wild card and sort of get some momentum and then decide, do we want to go long-term on Guerrero and Bichette? I think that's a little more what they're looking to do. And so then how does that vision where they sort of choose in that area, how does that then impact the draft? Because there is the, if you do the full like sort of tank start over, it's going to be 3 to 5 years. That then leans into high school players. Like, we're not going to be judged based on wins and losses at the big league level. next year. So why would we take a quick to the big leagues college player unless we really think he's the best guy in the whole league, messed up on this guy? Let's take another high upside high school guy like Brandon Barriera or Arjun Namala or another Adam Macko type who's, you know, traded for and has like made some strides this year. Whereas if it's going to be a sort of, you know, shuffle in place, we're going to like move the deck chairs around and we're going to figure out how to make this into a contender next season, then a quick to the big leagues college guy, maybe getting a, you know, bat that could be in Double A next year that gives you an option either to trade him or promote him or, you know, have it, let a free agent walk because he'll then take over that spot. I think that that thinking then gets different because at pick 20, like we were saying, the first tier and the second tier are probably gone. And so you can kind of justify anybody. At that point, it's the eye of the beholder. There's 20 guys you could justify drafting that'll be on the board that are in the same tier. So you kind of have to have a point of view. Whereas if you're picking at 9 or 10, there's probably a clear best guy or two or three guys you got to choose from. So your point of view of what you want to take doesn't really matter. Like the board is going to give you what it gives you. At 20, you can kind of take anybody. The idea of best player available once you get inside of the first two tiers is like sort of a made up concept because if the team thinks that they can fix every pitcher that has bad fastball shape, you're going to think the best player available is going to be a guy with a bad fastball shape that could be fixed. And so it doesn't really matter what like a fan thinks the best available on, you know, my rankings or Baseball America rankings or whatever is. They're just always going to be the kind of guy that they want. Like the hammer always sees a nail. And I don't know if Toronto has that to the point that we asked before is what is the point of view? What kind of guys are they trying to collect? Because I don't really see a consistency in how they're sort of using their young player prospect capital. Like what kind of players are they trying to get? It's just sort of like, this guy seems good, which is fine, but you usually don't beat 29 other teams if that's your point of view.
It's a tough way to do it, certainly. And you know, you look, obviously this time of year, we look through the recent draft history and stuff like that. And there's, I mean, I see like a bit of a thread with who they've had success with. And it's kind of the plate discipline, swing decisions, bat to ball, utility types that are quick through the minors, like Alan Rode and Josh Kosevich, you know, Spencer Horwitz types like that. But that doesn't mean you go and target those guys at 20, because the success is in finding those guys in the third round and the fifth round and later in things like that. With respect to that Jays direction at the trade deadline, you kind of said it there. You don't anticipate they'd do the blow it up thing. In terms of your feeling on that, given that, you know, when we factor in some ARB estimates and things like that, they've got about $190 million committed next year. If we take away only the guys who are pending free agents, you trade those guys away. They are obviously better than the 42-50 record they've showed this year. But given how this season's gone and how much is already committed, how confident would you be that this team can do enough over the offseason, graduate a couple guys from a weak farm system and spend, I don't know, the $70 million they'll have to spend or whatever, and make up that 15-20 games off of this year? Like, positive regression can't cover all of that, right?
Yeah, and like, I would say there's two ways of looking at this year's performance. You could say the run differential has them exactly where they are. So at some level, they have performed at this level as a team. But then you go look at the individual players and you're like, oh, like, you know, Varsho, I think, is better than this. And like Springer has like been a little hit unlucky. And then obviously Guerrero and Bichette seem like they are stars at times and are both not there right now, but both could be. But that, again, I don't think is like necessarily a fluke. Like there is some like hit unluckiness in the ex WOBA versus the WOBA with Vlad Jr. And all that kind of stuff. He'll probably consistently underperform because he's not the fastest guy in the world. And those things, you know, those kinds of players tend to underperform those metrics. But I don't think it's a coincidence that like some star players are underperforming at the same time that we're, you know, sort of talking every time I come on about how there isn't a necessarily cohesive player development and scouting point of view. While the big leagues and the scouting and development of the low minors are very different things with like almost no people overlapping internally that are doing both of those things at the same time. It's not surprising that they're not doing well when it's probably the same sort of philosophical limitations that are leading to that. And I could look silly and you know, next year Bichette and Guerrero have huge seasons and sign long-term deals and Gausman's the best pitcher in baseball and Barrios gets a little bit better and Varsho gets a little bit better and Springer has a career year. And all of a sudden this is a good team that doesn't need to, you know, move around, shuffle the deck or do anything. And then they, you know, sign a couple players and those players where you had a couple more Kiner Falefa types where you sign them to small deals and they end up being good players. And then Tiedemann and Aroldis Martinez are good. It's like, okay, we're not that far away. Like there is some three or four, you know, coin flips go your way and things sort of just get better. And you're saying the positive regression sort of way. And that's a competitive, you know, fringe wildcard team. But you could say that about literally every team in baseball, except for like four or five of them. Like, there's four or five teams that are like really laugh out loud terrible, that are not trying to be competitive, that are not close to competing. And then there's like 24 or 25 that, if things fall the right way, and they are the team that gets the most, like, you know, ball in play luck and sort of relative to the run differential luck, they'll make the playoffs, which we've seen with like the Giants the last 3 years. They've kind of had the same team a bunch of years in a row and then won the division and then didn't make the playoffs. It was kind of the same team. Like, that happens every now and then, but it's like one team per year, maybe two, and sometimes zero. So like, I would say, like, don't hope in place of a plan, but also you might look really smart next year. And it might be with a new GM, and it might be mostly the same team, and it might look, make it look like a bunch of stuff changed, when in fact somebody else was just standing there and the luck turned while he was standing there. He didn't really do anything that different. Like, there's a lot of different ways this can go, but I would argue that the deck is not looking fantastic right now. If you could, here, I'll ask you a question. How many guys on the big league roster are under contract next year and hopefully beyond, that were good last year, are good this year, and you think will be good next year?
Ooh, where is my 2025 breakdown? Okay. So last year as well. So so this doesn't include obviously prospects who are just fresh up.
Yeah,
right?
If we're talking about core players, it's guys that have done it, you know, for at least a year and a half, and are not like wildly overproducing their projections, and are not 33 to where it might fall off.
Yeah.
And ideally don't have their contract. So you kind of see where I'm going.
Five, like, maybe. Yeah. Yeah. And even then, that's a lot of like age risk with the starting rotation guys.
Yeah, and I would say, like, Gausman is an easy yes. I think you could say Bichette and Guerrero.
Yeah.
And then you would kind of be stretching, like, you could say, okay, maybe Varsho, maybe Springer, Bassett maybe. But it's like you couldn't really get past five or six.
Yeah.
And then you look at the teams like, you know, Philly and Atlanta and the Yankees and Baltimore that are kind of in the playoffs every year, and it's like you could argue it's like 14 for some of those teams. like it's a very different number. So it's like there's a way that it's crazy that this team could make the playoffs next year without changing that much. But also they're like five players short of being in the conversation in another way of looking at it.
And this is why I, you know, the idea of selling in 2024 with an eye toward 2025, I work here. We broadcast 162 games. They want to sell at Rogers Center. Everyone has a chance to make the playoffs unless you're Colorado or the White Sox. I get all of those things. But the amount of, like, you know, ifs that have to break right. And we're not talking about you, like, you didn't just lay that out. All those things break right, and the Blue Jays are a World Series contender on the level of the Yankees and the Orioles. Those things break, and you're back to, you know, competing for the second wild card, maybe trying to win a wild card series and see what happens. So it's a
88 wins and hoping your second starter is healthy enough that you're not depressed going into the playoffs, that like we got one good starter and one good reliever. Let's see what happens, which like happens sometimes. Like, that's just how it plays out every now and then.
Although right now I would kill to be depressed going into the playoffs, because it's better than being depressed not going to the playoffs. Want to zoom outside of the Blue Jays here for the last couple minutes. So MLB draft again, it starts on Sunday. Couple Canadians in your top 250 there. Brendan Lawson, I think, was the highest ranked one. Nathan Flewelling, who you know, I've started to hear a lot of good stuff, a Canadian catcher there. Emilian Petrie, who we saw in a pretty big spot with Kentucky in the NCAA tournament there. And then Dante Norrie, who is American but was born here because his dad was an assistant coach for the Raptors at the time that he was born.
I didn't know that one.
Yeah, Micah Norrie. So he was an assistant with the Timberwolves this year. If you watched any playoff basketball, he had to step in as head coach because their head coach suffered a knee injury on the sideline. Anyway, that's Dante Norrie's dad, and he was
that
born
guy sounds
in Toronto.
About as athletic as I am.
Yeah. So who do you, you know, those are the four guys kind of front of mind for me. Do you like any of those guys as potential, you know, second day values, or is there anyone else I'm missing on the Canadian side?
So I would say Lawson, Norrie, and Petre, if I'm saying that correctly, all are in the conversation, I think, in the back half of the second round. Okay. Or sort of, you know, somewhere in the third, sort of a priority guy on day two. Day one is two rounds, day two, 3 through 10. It always drives me nuts when other draft people talk about day two in the NFL draft. I'm like, I don't know what's in day two. Just give me the rounds. But all those guys are in the conversation. I would say Lawson and Norrie, I think, both have a distinct possibility of being late round two, early round three. Petre, I think, is more round three just because it's a, you know, smallish college second baseman, but everything else is pretty good. And then Flewelling, I think he's going to be one of those guys that gets moved around the board where it's going to be sort of later third round money could go in the third round, might even sneak into the late second, but I think might be one of those, oh, somebody saved some money in either round 7 or 11 or something. They, you know, pull together 500, 700K that they saved with other picks, because I think there's more of like 4 or 5 teams that are on him for a certain amount of money, whereas these other guys, I think there's, you know, 10 teams that are on him for similar money, so you have to kind of race to get him up at the top of the board. I think that's better than the average year where there's, you know, 5 sort of Canadian influenced guys, we'll say, that all could get, you know, over $500,000. I feel like most years there's, you know, the 19th Naylor brother shows up, and then, you know, one guy in the SEC, an Edouard Julien type. And then it's just like, I'm not sure if there's another Canadian guy involved. But yeah, I'd say this seems like an unusually good year for Canadian prospects. Am I reading that correctly? It feels like more than usual.
Yeah, I mean, it's more than we talked about last year, but we weren't doing as much draft stuff last year because the Jays were good and interesting leading into the draft. So, by necessity, we're doing a little bit more of it this time around. With respect to a guy like Flewelling, and this doesn't have to be about him because I know, you know, he's very, very young. He could go to Gonzaga and still maintain a lot of value. But with high school players in general, I know this is a down year for high school guys, so maybe it's not the best year to ask this question. But the introduction of NIL deals and things like that, and the fact that there are fewer minor league levels, fewer short season levels and things like that, how have you seen that impact on the draft, both players' willingness to go to college and teams' willingness to, you know, or maybe shift toward a more college-oriented draft approach? Let the NCAA handle some of the first years of player development that used to be like short-season minor league affiliates. Like, have you seen that impact yet?
That is a great question, because people don't like talking about this publicly, because I know coaches think that it undercuts their ability to coach and be seen as a recruiter when someone's like, hey, you just gave them $200,000. That's why they're here. It's not because of you. And like, there are guys that are like, that transferred at this time last year, are going to go in the first 2 rounds this year, could have gotten $200,000-$400,000 and went somewhere for $50,000 in NIL money because they're going there to develop. And $50,000 is what the school could find for them. Like, there are multiple examples of that I know, because if someone's like, hey, I'm worth $3 million now, I think I might be worth $6 million if I go to this school. Like, that is a reasonable way to think about it. I have heard of, I won't say the schools, but if you could just guess, almost entirely SEC schools, the 5 or 6, 7 or 8 schools that have all the money. There's a guy that's rumored to go on the first day, more of a second round pick, that has been offered $300,000 to $500,000 to come back. But has a, I would say his over under is, you know, somewhere between $1 million to $1.5 million. And then he basically will not get $1 million if he goes back to school and then enters the draft again, and then runs the risk of, you know, getting hurt or whatever. So if you're kind of working through that, you're like, I don't know, $1.4 million or $400K and question mark, like, maybe that's not good business, but that's now a conversation, and that's never really been a conversation. There's also rumors of, I haven't been able to substantiate this, there's rumors of another one of these 6 or 8 schools with all the money offering like giant money, like maybe guaranteeing $1 million while they're on campus to a high school player, to get them to pull their name out of the draft, or if they don't kind of like what's coming their way, to get them to commit to the college, which is super risky because these guys haven't played in college. And sometimes really good toolsy high school players are just sort of, you know, role players until their junior year. And so sort of spending the money you would spend on a premium guy is a little scary to maybe get nothing for it. But I would think the benefit would be, what if that happens? If some high school guy turns down $2 million to get a guaranteed $1 million to go to college for 3 years, ends up being good, and now every time you draft a player that's committed to that college, every team is scared that the college is going to show up with a bunch of money and he's going to pull out of the deal that he made with you. And now you don't get a player. You got to wait another year. Maybe you get fired as the scouting director. Like, it might be a good investment as like a, you know, like a cooling effect on everyone drafting your players, because they might not be there anymore. And I don't know if any of this is true, but I can also say I've been in touch with some agents that have represented college players in the portal. And I would say the players that are in that like top 2, 3, maybe 4 round area, they're like universally getting almost double what they thought they were going to get. Like, there's a lot more money floating around. I know of one school that you would say, oh, that school's a lot of money. They had like $100K to spend a year or two ago, and now have over $1 million to spend. Wow. And, you know, are adding players left and right. Like, this is, and none of this is like, I can tell you the number is $1.2 million, and this guy got exactly $300,000, and like some, you know, chicken wings place came in and gave him this much. Like, it's hard to nail it down, so nobody really reports it. But the scale of the money has like drastically jumped in the last year or two, to a point where I don't know how these schools are making the money to justify giving a guy that might not start on Fridays or Saturdays $200,000. $1,000. Are they making more money in ticket sales because this guy is here? Like, I don't really know.
I think the answer is that they were always making a lot more money, and now players just get to share in it, and it's the first couple years of us hearing about that. So there was my gut is that there was more money to begin with than maybe they wanted to let on, and then competitive instinct takes over or whatever. But it does, I don't know, it kind of feels, and this is from Canada where college baseball isn't a huge thing here, but it does feel like it's picked up interest and steam the last couple years as well. Maybe a Paul Skeens effect there, but I don't know. Is that a fair read? Like, does it seem on your end like there's been more interest in the college game?
I think what's happening is if the boosters are not super enthusiastic about the football and basketball programs at their school, I think the money gets directed to baseball. And I think, for example, Texas A&M was paying a bunch of money to Jimbo Fisher and then fired him and bought out the rest of his contract, the football coach, and then all of a sudden got some really good players playing baseball. Because I think like some of the booster money was like, yeah, let's like steer away from football this season because we don't like where this is going, and put it in baseball. And then they made Omaha. And so I think the money might be staying around. And I don't think they're the only school where that happened. Like, Tennessee was not a baseball school, and then they got a new coach, and they've made Omaha multiple years in a row. And so I think some of like that, you know, Rocky Top football money that like dipped into basketball every now and then is now running over to baseball because they're getting results, and they like showing up to Omaha and sitting in a suite and taking a picture with, you know, with the team and getting to shake hands with the coach, and he comes to their, you know, car dealership or whatever. Like, it doesn't have to return $200,000 for each player into the program if just like some random guy thinks this is a fun way to spend his money. Like, it doesn't have to get a return. And that's always kind of been like, you know, back when it was completely sort of illegal to to NCAA rules, like $100,000 in a bag and a handshake to a quarterback. Like, that guy didn't get $100,000 back. He got $100,000 of enjoyment of watching the guy and being like, that's my guy. And I think that might be happening in baseball now, which I think is great, but I can get some people don't think that's great.
Yeah. I mean, hey, as long as it's money funneling toward the actual labor, I'm going to find a way where I'm cool with it. Kylie, I took up way too much of your time, man. Thanks so much for taking the time out and doing this.
Yeah, and I'll finish with this. You talked about trying to get to depressed, but as an American that likes our soccer team and, you know, pays attention to politics, oh boy, you guys have got a lot better right now.
Yeah, at least on one of those fronts. We'll see how they do in the bronze here. Kylie McDaniel of ESPN, thanks again, man. Keep up all the great work, and good luck with the draft this weekend.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Kylie McDaniel of ESPN. Make sure you're following along all their terrific work heading into the draft here. Yeah, top 250. Is up there from Kylie, as well as big questions facing each team. And yeah, some good insight into, I guess, not into the Blue Jays front office's thinking, but the kind of curiosity from the rest of the league as to what the Blue Jays front office is thinking here, both trade deadline related and larger picture. You know, what is your player development philosophy? Where are your strengths? We will have Shane Farrell on the show tomorrow, by the way, the Blue Jays scouting director. So we'll get to pick his brain a little bit about that as well. Right now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, talk to Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, get a check-in on the Mariners and kind of whip around everywhere here. Maybe preview that home run derby that's coming up as well. An old friend, Teoscar Hernandez, in there since Vlad declined his spot to try to win another one. And Pete Alonso doing a fifth in a row. Good for him. Meg Rowley joins us next of Effectively Wild as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays have split two against the Giants. They'll try to win a series today like they did in Seattle this weekend. The Mariners have bounced right back, though, and beat the Padres two in a row. They'll start the first of four against the Angels today, and that takes us into All-Star Weekend beyond that, including the Home Run Derby. Let's check in with Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, of Effectively Wild. Meg, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am excellent, thank you. Seattle Mariners, usually when the Blue Jays fans invade like that, I understand it can be a little annoying if you're a Mariners fan, probably. But historically, the Mariners win all those series. How did you feel about this weekend coming out on the other end of that? I'd imagine quite a frustrating series watching the Mariners in that one, given the amount of squandered opportunities against a very bad Blue Jays team.
Yeah, I don't want to knock your Blue Jays too much, but you do want to take advantage of series against not inferior competition, but compromised competition.
Sure.
And that didn't seem to happen, although I'm glad that all of Western Canada got to watch a good show.
They were fun games. That part is good. So the Mariners are still hanging on in the American League West. The Astros have closed that to two games. And maybe these two wins against the Padres, maybe sweeping that two-game set helps. But the Mariners had dropped 12 of 17 there for a minute. What do you make of where the Mariners are kind of big picture here at the All-Star break check-in?
Sure. So sometimes when a team isn't performing as well as you'd like them to, you struggle. Like, what's wrong with them? Why are they underperforming? At least with the Mariners, the problems are pretty easy to diagnose, which is their offense has just been god-awful this year. If I were going to take anything particularly hopeful out of their recent set against the Padres, apart from the wins, is that it seems like Julio Rodriguez is maybe getting better, I think, or getting going, rather. I think it's a big mystery why he's having the struggles that he is this year. If you look at his sort of peripheral statistics, he's not all that far off from last year, at least from that blazing second half. So, you know, it always feels like the Mariners offense goes the way that Julio goes, but their problems are much broader than that. I think they don't have very many guys who are producing at even a league average level right now. So I imagine that bats will be a priority for them come the deadline, although I don't know that there's really a sort of game-changing talent available in the market this year. I think that one of the things that is going to be interesting is that with so many clubs, especially in the National League, within striking distance of at least a wild card spot, I don't know how many aggressive sellers there are really going to be. And apart from the White Sox, the teams that we can identify as perhaps ready to do a hard reset don't really have the guys to change a playoff race. So it's going to be interesting to see how much activity we even get. I wonder if we'll end up with some buyer-to-buyer trades just as a way to kind of grease the wheels.
Yeah, be interesting to see how that goes. It's I'm sure it's nice to just the Mariners in firm buy mode. You know, they're probably not going to sell their closer this year while they're in a wild card race or anything like that. Your colleague Eric Longenhagen just dropped last week as well the Mariners kind of top prospects report. And while it's not the deepest farm system, there's a lot of like pretty good talent at the top end. I think Baseball America had them with 8 in the top 100. I don't think Eric was quite as high on them as that, but how encouraging is that for you when you look ahead to, hey, the Mariners' ability to get something done?
I think that it's pretty encouraging. It's encouraging because the posture of the team is one of we would like to take advantage of a relatively down AL West and actually acquire talent that we see as moving the needle for us in the playoff race this year. I think that they have been sort of coming and going in prior seasons where they're trading away important guys or at least important to the clubhouse. I think that the Paul Sewald deal looks a little less bad in hindsight. You know, he's a closer who sits 92. And I've enjoyed watching him as a pitcher, and I think he can still be effective. But they did end up getting some guys back in that deal from Arizona who I think have been useful for them this year. But yeah, I think that it's encouraging that they have some players who I think are good and who, you know, maybe the industry consensus is a little higher on than we have been at Fangraphs. We don't view this as like a terrible system or anything, and they have a couple of top 100 guys, but I think that some of their best prospects have been either injured or further away from the majors, so that's depressing their future value at the moment. Honestly, the most heartening thing to me as a Mariners fan editing that list was, they might actually be developing some hitting here, right? Like the big strength, the core strength of this team over the last couple of years has been what they've been able to do with pitching, both selecting guys and also helping the guys they have in-house augment their existing repertoires. And I think that we've seen them be able to help some of their younger position player prospects make appreciable and important changes to their swings. So if, you know, I don't want to say that they're suddenly a great hitter development system, because I think it takes, a little bit longer than, you know, Cole Young and Cole Emerson looking good, and Johnny Formello for that matter, to say that. But I think it's an encouraging indicator. So,
Most important Mariners question is not related to the trade deadline. It is related to something that'll happen the week before the trade deadline, and that is the run of Salmon Run t-shirts that they are, you know, that you can get. I think it's July 24th. Which is your favorite of the Salmon Run characters that the Mariners have been doing this year?
Blake, I'm so glad that you asked the most important question of our lifetime, potentially. So many of these team promos are kind of, you know, they're cutesy. They feel a little bit forced. And then sometimes a team hits upon something that feels so pure, so good. It's humpy, like by a landslide for me. What a weird, deranged little guy he appears to be. I feel like Humpy is my kindred spirit in this particular moment. As I mentioned to your producer when I opted for phone only, the amount of work over the last couple of weeks has turned me into a weird draft gremlin. So I feel like Humpy really speaks to my soul at this particular juncture.
I maybe would have guessed Silver, you know, got the headphones in for the podcasting, glasses on to get the work done. But no, that's when you start the project and then it's Humpy by the end of the project, right?
Yes, exactly.
So how the draft is obviously this weekend. You guys do a ton of work. I know you're editing some of Eric's work. You're looking at prospect as well. Michael Bauman was on the show yesterday and told me that he filed stuff late because he was busy looking up prospects from Marietta, Georgia and things like that. How much do you enjoy the draft and the draft coverage from the editor perspective?
I think that they've done a really great job with, you know, with their setup in the last couple of years. I'm skeptical that the draft will ever be quite as big a phenomenon for baseball as it is for, say, the NFL, just because the guys that, you know, there are obviously exceptions to this, but in general, the players who are being selected, they get picked, everyone gets excited, and that's like, okay, see you in 5 years. So I think the sort of delayed gratification of the MLB draft is just always going to put a ceiling on it. But, you know, I think it's one of the most genuinely exciting times of year. There are so many good stories, even in a draft like this that isn't, you know, compared to some of the recent ones we've had, particularly deep and doesn't have the same kind of impact talent at the top that we've seen in prior years. You know, there are guys who are going to end up being really important contributors to playoff teams in a couple of years, and to get to know them and know their game now and then see how they're able to evolve and weather the grind of the minor league process, I think is really exciting. We have a switch pitcher this year.
Yeah.
I mean, what's not to like about this draft?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. Switch pitcher, a couple two-way players. There's also and like a switch pitcher who could go in the like middle of the first round too.
Oh, yeah.
in Cinche. So that's really exciting. It's also This year is the most I've ever done draft stuff on the show because the Blue Jays are bad. And, you know, if we were talking, hey, who are they adding at the deadline? These games are really important. It would maybe be different. So that's one, I guess, silver lining of the way the Jays season has gone. Meg, what do you make of the Jays season from afar? I know at the start of the year when you guys put out the Fangraphs staff predictions, it was less optimistic about the Blue Jays than the past 2 years and less optimistic than some of the other major sites out there. I believe only 8 of 25 Fangraphs staff had the Jays in the postseason, but I don't think anyone would have thought it would have gone quite like this.
Yeah, they've definitely underperformed relative to my expectation. I think that at the beginning of the year, a lot of that sort of pessimism on the part of the staff was driven by their projections, but mostly just the division that they play in. Like having to deal with the AL East, you know, as a person who tends to root for a team in the West, you know, it can be really tough when you have that kind of competition. And to have to deal with the Orioles, the Yankees, the Rays, the Red Sox have done much better than I thought they were going to. But I just thought that they were poorly positioned in terms of their existing big league roster relative to those other clubs. I think that, you know, when you look at their farm system relative to some of those other teams, they haven't had a great time of it of late. This year hasn't gone particularly well for them. You know, Ricky Tiedemann is hurt again. So when you're looking at sort of their ability to reinforce from within, I thought that they were compromised relative to a team, certainly like the Orioles, which just seems to have, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do with all of these position players that they have floating around in the minors. Do you think that they have to do a consolidation trade at some point? So I thought that relative to both where they were on opening day and their ability to get better as the season progressed relative to some of the other teams in that division, that they were compromised. But yeah, I didn't expect for things to go quite as badly as this. And it feels like, you know, I think one of the last times we talked, we were trying to figure out, like, what's wrong with Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? And if you told me, hey, you know, Vladdy's going to have a 135 WRC plus, I'm like, great. The Blue Jays are going to be in great position. I'm sure they're going to be competitive in the East. They're at least going to be in a wild card spot. And then you look down the rest of their lineup and it's like, well, Bo Bichette has like a WRC plus in the 60s. So, you know, the push and pull there hasn't quite worked out. I don't know what this team does particularly well at this juncture. I think that you certainly can look to the big league rotation and see promise there. If, you know, you were looking to maybe move on from this particular season and try to restock a farm system that's pretty shallow, you know, maybe you look to move some of those guys, but they're just kind of down across the board. And if you look at their sort of underlying metrics, their base runs record, it's not like they're, you know, they should be 10 wins better than they are at present. Like, this is kind of what they are.
Yeah, which is, you know, I it makes it a little tough. I was just talking with Kylie McDaniel in the last segment of, you know, when this idea of sell the expiring contracts and be good again for 2025, I understand it, like, intellectually, I understand it from a business standpoint, but you got to make up like 15 games. You know, it's not like you're a 500 team with a good underlying run differential. You're quite far away. So I know that you guys at Fangraphs, quickly after the draft, will have to pivot to deadline stuff. Ben Clemens will have his trade value series and things like that. You mentioned earlier in talking about the Mariners, it's a bit of an interesting deadline to figure because there could be not that many aggressive sellers. How interested are you in the Blue Jays if they do decide to sell, even if it is just the kind of rental pieces?
They're interesting, right? Because I think the fundamental question that Toronto needs to answer is, like, what do you want to do with Vlad long-term, right? Because easily the most valuable player they could potentially have on offer is Guerrero. If you're not going to extend him, I don't know, like, maybe this is the year that you look to move him. It would be a tremendous bummer for the fans. So I'm not advocating that. And I do think that he's the kind of guy who, even though he seems to have, you know, course corrected on the bat, you know, right first base is a tricky position. I know he's sometimes playing third, but, like, he's a first baseman, really. So, you know, I don't know that actually nets you what you want, but if you're not going to keep him around, if you're not going to offer him an extension, you know, maybe you look at moving him. I really don't know that this is the right time to try to move Bichette. And I know that, you know, some of this might end up being a moot point depending on what the injury from yesterday looks like and how severe it is. If he's compromised by injury, his trade value is going to be torpedoed anyway. But, you know, this has been a pretty lousy season for him. So I don't know that he recoups much in the way of prospects. You know, I think the rotation and the guys there are, you know, potentially your most interesting moves. But some of them are going to be limited by how soon the contracts expire, right? Like, this is, you know, the last year of Kikuchi's deal. You get Bassett for, you know, basically a year and a half, but is he going to be like a, you know, a playoff race altering guy? Like, he's a good pitcher, but I don't know that he's going to move the needle for any of the contenders. But, you know, everybody needs pitching. So, you know, he might be outside of the guys who Chicago has to offer one of the better options out there. I don't know. They're in a tricky spot because the team at the big league level isn't all that great. You do have individual guys who are having okay seasons, but I don't know that any of them really gets you like a return of prospects that changes the fortunes of the farm system fundamentally. It does give you an injection of talent, and, you know, given where they are as a farm, that would be welcome. But I don't know that you're not getting like a top prospect, the top prospect in baseball back for any of these guys, right? Even for Vladdy. So I think you're probably looking at, you know, volume rather than, you know, having a really high impact guy come back in return. So I don't really know what the right move for them is.
It's tough. Yeah, this is it's a bad major league club that's very expensive, and it's not a great farm system. It's not a great spot to be in. Let's change the vibe here to close out, Meg.
Yeah.
And I know you guys were kicking around on Effectively Wild earlier this week, or maybe late last week, you know, trying to quantify the impact of smiles, which we're not going to try to do right now. But we found out yesterday that Teoscar Hernandez, the best smile in the game, is going to be the final participant in the Home Run Derby. So let's take a look at that field, see how you feel about it. So it's Gunnar Henderson, Pete Alonso, Alec Baum, Bobby Witt Jr., Marcell Ozuna, Jose Ramirez, Adolis Garcia at home, and Teoscar Hernandez. How are you feeling about the Home Run Derby field?
Weird field, right?
Yeah.
Like some of these guys make a ton of sense. Gunnar, absolutely. Put him in there. You have to have Adolis Garcia, both because he hits tanks and because you got to have a hometown guy. He's the perfect option there. I think Teoscar is like a sneaky good addition, and he's having a great season. You know, I think every franchise jokes about how the guys get better when they leave town, but boy, Teoscar, he had a rough time in Seattle, having a great time with the Dodgers. Good for him. Bohm is such a weird addition to me. Like, Bohm is having a tremendous season, and I think that, like, that part of it is great, but, like, of all the guys that I would pick to be, like, a power-hitting force in the Derby, I don't know that the 11 home run guys who I'm picking, like, the 41 slug guy, I don't know. So that part of it's strange. Ozuna's having a great year, but that's, like, not an uncomplicated case to root for as a person. So there's that piece of it. And I guess, you know, you got to put Pete Alonso in the Derby until that guy is done, because it's a mainstay at this point. And I am dying to know how Pete Alonso, who seems to have the most detailed, rigorous pre-Derby routine, is going to adapt to the new format. Right? He's going to have, like, Alonso's got to be on tilt for this whole thing, right?
Yeah. And look, my suggestion is, while he's hitting, live performance of OMG by Candelita. So that's the, I don't know. He's got to get his title back some way or another here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that anyone in the history of the Derby has taken it as seriously as Pete Alonso has.
Which is fun. It's part of what it it's part of what it needs. So I think I'm gonna pick Teo, just because I don't know, I have an affinity for Teo. Forced to pick here, who are you going with?
Probably Adolis, because I think, just like, of all the guys in that field, and there are some thumpers, like, I think he has the most raw juice. And as we saw in the postseason last year, when he has a mostly home crowd cheering for him to hit a long ball, he tends to do it. So I think I'm taking Adolis.
All right. That's a pretty good pick, and it would send the hometown crowd happy. Meg, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Keep up all the great work at Fangraphs. Love the new player pages, by the way.
Oh, great. Thank you so much.
Meg Rowley of Fangraphs, of the Effectively Wild podcast. Yeah, I mean, we bring someone from Fangraphs on basically every day. You don't need me to tell you how great that site is, but if it's not a site you check regularly, do that. And yeah, the new player pages are a lot of fun. Also a lot of fun, I hope, this 3:45 p.m. game today. Kevin Gausman against old friend Jordan Hicks. Jordan Hicks, if you don't know, since we last saw him, has converted back into a starting pitcher. There was a lot of skepticism, or not a lot of skepticism, but there was healthy skepticism around baseball that he'd be able to make that transition, given what he'd been like as a reliever, given that his walk rate was always really, really high, and that was kind of his limiting factor, even as a relief pitcher. The Giants make that bet. They make a bet of 4 years, $44 million, that they can do it. And part of the strategy here, and I'm going to talk about this on Blue Jay Central later, is, well, one, Jordan Hicks added a splitter, which is a really good pitch. He's one of only five pitchers in baseball who regularly throw two different pitches that get a 40% whiff rate or higher. So you've got two big swing and miss options, and that sinker. Now, we remember that sinker as like 100 mile an hour. He'll whip it all around. It's a ground ball machine kind of thing. The ground ball rate isn't quite as high as last year. That sinker gets squared up. But what they've really focused on in San Francisco is he's down like 5 miles an hour almost on that sinker. They've really had him dial it back a little bit, I think in part so he can stretch out as a starter and not give it 100% every single pitch like he had out of the bullpen. But also the command on it has really gotten better. He has a career low walk rate by far. He throws that pitch in the zone more than he ever has. So really interesting change to the Jordan Hicks profile. Also something for the Blue Jays to watch out in this matchup is that he will throw a lot of first pitch breaking ball. So even though that sinker is still his number one pitch and he throws it in the zone a bunch, he'll try to sneak through an 0-0 breaking ball I almost said 0-0 breaking ball, which is technically correct, but sounds just so weird. We'll see how that goes with Jordan Hicks. I'll break it down a little bit more on Blue Jay Central later. Kevin Gausman on the other side. We went through the big home road splits with Chris Black earlier, and it's really not a home road split. It is a good team versus bad team split. He's just run into really good competition at home, weaker competition on the road. This is a team that hits slightly below average against right-handed pitching. It's a pitcher-friendly park. Maybe a good day for Kevin Gausman to build on that last outing where he felt he found something mechanically with the splitter. We're done for today. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break this one down for you and set up that Diamondbacks series. Thank you to Chris Black, to Kylie McDaniel, to Meg Rowley. Thank you to Andrew Adams, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Blair and Barker will be with you post-game to break this one down for Jays Talk, since obviously that game is on during their show. We'll be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Hope you all have a wonderful Thursday and enjoy the Jordan Hicks experience. Have a good one.